Today on This Week in Black History, Society, and Culture, we have Dr. Brenna Wynn Greer, who will discuss her work on the history of Black image makers who reimagined African-American citizenship. I'm Catherine Parkin, your host. First, we will discuss Dr. Greer's teaching and research interests, and then we'll get into a discussion of her book, Represented, which is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Dr. Greer, your work has been recognized nationally by grants from top foundations and the awarding of prizes for an article on Moss Kendrick and your book, Represented. At Wellesley College, you've been recognized for your excellence in scholarship and teaching by being named an endowed chair and receiving the college's highest teaching honor. Can you please tell us more about your scholarship and teaching interests?
Sure. First, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. Well, my scholarship interests are completely driven by my teaching interests, and that's always been the case. I never had ever had plans to get a doctorate, didn't even really know what that was. And I did go to grad school for a master's program in Afro-American studies. And during that, as part of my funding, I was a teaching assistant. And in teaching African-American history and African-American literature, one of the things that became frustrating in the classroom was that a lot of my students just really had difficulty in conceiving of or dealing with complex Black characters, Black historical actors. And that just kind of got me on these questions about why that is. What was making it so difficult for students across race lines to be able to really deal with Black people in history? And at the same time, I was researching the Montgomery bus boycott and knew that a lot of the images that come out or the ideas that came out of that movement, particularly of Rosa Parks and kind of her demure, accidental activist idea, were in part of her making in terms of, you know, a public performance and representations that she put out there. And so that led to questions, the base of which has been for almost 20 years now, why do people see Black people the way they do? And that is, I would say, that fundamental question kind of guides my research and is what led me from someone who was kind of a straight civil rights historian in a conventional sense, looking at activism, looking at visual culture and markets. And my teaching has tracked that and somewhat compelled that. I teach, you know, I'm a 20th century U.S. historian, so I teach courses in World War II and Cold War, but I also teach courses in fashion and visual culture and consumerism, and all of those come together in my work in terms of looking at, you know, how representations, and in particular representations of Black citizenship, are enacted through the market and through consumerism. So it has been that my interest in teaching and the questions that my students ask have always been the thing that kind of pushes me to the next question or to the next way to demonstrate the dynamics that I see related to the questions that I'm asking.
So interesting, and interesting to hear how organic it is that in trying to help people understand, you're reaching for ways that they had been reached before, right? The visual and the market are two of the most dominant ways in which we're teaching and learning about the past. So interesting. I want to use that introduction to you and your work to segue into your book, your wonderful book, Represented. And the subtitle is The Black Image Makers Who Reimagined African-American Citizenship. And you start off your introduction with an epigraph from bell hooks. Mm-hmm. And she writes, I'm quoting her here, "The history of the Black liberation movements in the United States could be characterized as a struggle over images." It's a perfect opening to your work as you consider the ways that images were central to Black liberation movement and how those images have been created and consumed. So could you tell us about one of the characters, one of the individuals who you found using these images to shape African-American citizenship, namely Moss Kendricks? Mm-hmm. And It's so surprising because he is a public relations specialist. How does this man come to play such a significant role that was unknown and unheralded until your work?
Yeah, no, I think Moss Kendricks is so interesting to me, obviously. And I stumbled on him. I'd never heard of him. I stumbled onto his papers in just a really fortuitous set of circumstances. And he was a public relations expert that was trained in doing work for the New Deal during the 1930s, and then also on behalf of the Black Press, and then went into commercial public relations really after World War II. But for African American marketers, public relations was kind of, inherent to marketing, because so much of what African-American marketers were doing, particularly for large white corporations, was also being an ambassador to Black communities. So it wasn't just a matter of here's, some print ads or, advertising that you might create. It was also needing to create inroads within Black communities. So that's where that public relations aspect really came, became very central to what I needed to look at to understand Kendricks and how he was a marketer and a public relations expert, and how those things were definitely related, but also their own distinct things. Mm. And then that required my learning a lot more about the history of public relations than I had ever anticipated. Which was actually when I did the dissertation that the book grew out of. The dissertation was really focused from World War II through 1950. But in doing the book, I really needed to go back into the 1930s to contextualize Kendricks as a public relations practitioner, but also the growth of public relations that he really is growing along with. And then I argue he's also helping to shape coming out of the World War II era. So he is the central figure. His professional career, or the biography of his professional career, is the through line for the book. And he helped me to see, he acts as a really useful node for recognizing the connection between, ideas of citizenship, but also this growth of or rise of consumerism as an activity, but also as a political kind of identity, or at least a site for political claims, and then also social movements that were emerging at the time.
It's one of your significant contributions, I think, is to say that the civil rights movement that we know is not complete. That really this underlying business angle is really, it's early and it's powerful through the efforts of men, and they are really all men, like Kendricks, who are arguing to these businesses and for these businesses that African Americans should be understood as citizens and as citizen consumers.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, I think it's probably in the blurb in the book or on the back of the book where, a main point is that representing African Americans, as citizens or asserting Black citizenship and creating media representations that did assert that was good business in the world, in the post-World War II moment, partly because of changes in marketing and media, but also because it was a consumer demand among African Americans, and they had a position, an advanced position, to be able to compel, as a consumer market, to compel a response to that demand. And Kendricks and I also write about John Johnson, were central to being able to fill that demand. I think that, I make it very clear in the book that I am not writing about them as activists. And that's not to deny them any activist, politics or sensibilities, but that's not what I was focused on. And precisely because I was intent on, speaking to what I was seeing, was that through their activities as capitalists, as entrepreneurs, marketers who were facilitating particular media representations, they were facilitating contemporary civil rights agendas by creating cultural conceptions of African Americans as citizens, but also, to your point, consumer citizens, which was so central in a post-World War II, early Cold War capitalism versus communism context.
And they're doing so in, and I think you're right, actually, to not consider them as activists, but as business people, they are in a fight because the resistance to including African Americans is so powerful. And the businesses, the corporations are so resistant into the late 20th and into the 21st century. You know, the studies of representation are abysmal. And so the idea that African Americans could ever push beyond a 3% representation in magazine portrayals is hard to take, you know, for a business person like Hendricks, who's saying there are 11 or 12% of the market and you're not reaching them. You're not putting your money there. And corporations were afraid, and they're afraid of displeasing their white consumers. And so they're not compelled in general to take the accounts to build this business. And Hendricks is out there trying to make this case, and I think it really matters to be visible, to be represented, and as part of, and I think you maybe in your consideration of Johnson talk more about this, the consideration of African Americans as a middle class America. Mm-hmm. And so that is so vital to the portrayal, that it's not just that they showed up as they had in the early 20th century in roles as workers, as servants or porters on the train or what have you, but to just be the middle class aspiration is really the goal.
Yeah, you know, and it's really important to say that Hendricks wouldn't be who Hendricks was if not for John Johnson, because John Johnson, to your point, a lot of advertisers, you know, did not see the use in approaching or targeting African Americans as consumers, but also did not want to be seen as approaching or targeting African American consumers, lest they, you know, offend the general market, by which, you know, meant means white Americans. And Johnson gave, through his publications, through Ebony Magazine, really gave a place, accomplished two things. One, really exposed Black consumer markets, you know, across class lines, just by the circulation of Ebony Magazine. And then also gave advertisers media space that they could target African Americans that was somewhat contained. And that allowed for Hendricks to be able to leverage that media space with advertisers, that media space and evidence, you know, of a consumer market of African Americans that were, if not middle class, aspiring to be middle class, which was true of Hendricks and Johnson, right? These were two very working class backgrounds, and then rose to these middle class positions, and then, you know, in Johnson's case, especially to right. position, right? But so that was a journey that they had experienced themselves and helped really promote and sell among advertisers. And then with Ebony Magazine itself was really, you know, has been described many times as a manual for kind of a Black middle class lifestyle. It was certainly more than that, but it allowed for the popularization of a Black middle class that was, you know, more in line with a middle class idea of just kind of, you know, the American dream, Americanness versus, you know, a quote unquote respectable elite idea that was attached to non-working class African Americans prior to World War II.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Let me turn to some of those images of working African Americans, and I'm thinking in particular of your work looking at photographer Gordon Parks. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us how you see Parks' work shaping a narrative about rightful citizenship of African Americans in the 1940s?
Yeah, it's interesting because I just did a talk for a group of students, and the teacher had assigned the book, except for the chapter that is written about Gordon Parks, which I can understand because he's not a through line in the same way that Johnson and Kendricks are. But the reason that he was so important to my book was because he was the portal to understanding the image of African-Americanness that was becoming popularized during World War II. And Parks, as someone who worked for the Office of War Information, was in this, I think, interesting position in that he had come to the Office of War Information largely on his talent, well, on his talents as a photographer, but photographing, you know, the South Side of Chicago and the conditions of African Americans living in the South Side of Chicago, conditions, you know, rooted in racism. But then comes into the Office of War Information as part of that photography unit's team that's supposed to go forth and show this united, strong American front. And so then is producing photographs or is tasked with producing photographs that give that kind of propagandist image. But in doing that, in speaking to that call or responding to that call, he goes out and he takes photographs. I mean, he's photographing, you know, many subjects, but when he's photographing African-Americans, he's photographing them in ways that put them into the frame of, you know, contemporary ideas of Americanness at that point in time, which would have been patriotic, hardworking, civic-minded. And his photographs, I write, bring African-Americans into this American story in an image that is both desired by African-Americans and at that point, the state. And I use Parks to show that he is able, as an activist artist, which is how he really viewed himself, he is able to work within this state propaganda organization because World War II is the time, you know, a point in U.S. history when Black representation desires and state needs for the representation of Black people aligned in a way that his sensibilities were useful to the Office of War Information. And then I use Parks to kind of come out of World War II to see how the images that were popularized during World War II then make their way into a commercial setting through people like Kendricks and Johnson, but also through Gordon Parks, right? That it becomes a popular idea, it becomes possible because it has been legitimized by the state, this image of African-Americans in a way that's, you know, against stereotype and writes them into the story of the nation.
Yes. And does so from this working class perspective. So it's idealized. And one of your examples is, of course, the American Gothic,
right,
with a Black woman positioned, and this is a staged photograph, holding a broom and a mop and standing in front of the American flag. And I think it's a wonderful challenge to American identity as agricultural and white and heteronormative and all that. And here's this working class Black woman symbolizing American identity, hard work, and just an incredible example of what you're describing.
No, and he, you know, a lot of the photographs, you know, there obviously there's limits to things that you could put in the book, and the American Gothic is so well known among people and such interesting stories behind it. But a lot of the photographs, and I write this in the book, that Parks takes of African Americans during that time are so they're beautiful. They're just beautiful portraits, yes, of people being really attuned to and proud of who they are and where they are in the community. They're almost always completely, you know, segregated. You know, one of the reasons his photographs work the way they do or are able to work the way they do in that World War II setting is actually the Black people are absent of white people.
Yeah. Right?
So that is a way too that they were able to work not as indictments of race, actually, in a weird paradoxical way. But I think his photographs from his work during with the Office of War Information are some of my favorites.
I loved them. I was reminded of a story, I hope you won't mind, that my white grandfather told me about being a supervisor during the war, Second World War, at a military production site. And the country was under orders, as was his plant, from the president to racially integrate the workforce. Mm. And several white women approached him. It was a segregated workforce, and told him that if they had to work alongside black women, that they would quit. Right. And he told them, there's the door. And I was struck in looking at the photographs and thinking about their importance, that if there had been representation of one of the images you include is a beautiful woman welder trainee. Yes. And she's Rosie the Riveter, right? She's an American patriot doing unusual work, what had traditionally been white men's work. Mm-hmm. Here she was, a symbol of American wherewithal to win this war. And I was struck by the ability to sell that message to the American people. And I was wondering if the very working class nature of the photographs helps. And not to say that being in the military was not a working class endeavor, but I think Americans have historically, at least, you know, if we look to the First World War, Second World War, found black men and women in military uniform to be especially hard to whites found. Let me say, many whites found black people in military uniforms to be an affront to right. Americanness. Right. Did you see or did you analyze any photographs of black people in military uniform?
Not specifically, although one of the things that I do touch on is how how the Crisis magazine, the NAACP Crisis magazine, very much circulated on its covers in the magazine, but also on its covers, which I think is important because covers float in the, you know, they are seen by eyes that aren't necessarily trying to see them. They were definitely circulating images of African American men and women in the military throughout World War II in a way to, you know, I always tell my students that, you know, wars are always an opportunity when marginalized communities assert their citizenship, their belonging, their national belonging, their patriotism, right? Certainly not all, but I mean, that is an opportunity. And this is the crisis was taking advantage of that opportunity to, you know, to place black men in particular, but black men and women in spaces or ideals historically and stereotypically occupied by white men and white women. I do think that it was useful that a lot of the photographs that were produced by the Office of War Information, not just Gordon Parks, but of African Americans during war, were of working class individuals for two reasons. One, I think it didn't affront American audiences, broader American audiences, in the way that say images of African Americans in military uniforms or even, you know, in looking to have wealth of any kind might have. But it also, before World War II, before the Cold War era, that kind of working class idea has a lot of currency within U.S. culture, right? It's still that, you know, like salt of the earth, you know, hard worker idea. And I think that that was very useful to elevating African Americans as part of, you know, part of the national project at that point in time, and working class, not poor, which many were, but I mean, it was a different, in terms of representation, you know, a different kind of idea that is than what is often attached to African Americans who are lower income.
A really excellent point. And of course, the context being that the country had just come through the war out of the Great Depression. So many people had been struggling and seeking to get back or to achieve that ideal. So really wonderful point. One of the most surprising subjects of your analysis is when your work follows Kendricks to West Africa. And I wondered if you could talk about some of your observations with his work in Monrovia, Liberia. You title the chapter Selling Progress. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, surprising is exactly the word. It's certainly not where I thought I would be going. There are so many, and I think this is probably true for everyone, particularly with their first book. There are so many things that I had to learn to just follow the project where it was going. And Moss Kendricks, in his papers, there were just all these papers about the Republic of Liberia. And that just, you know, my focus on him had been Coca-Cola, him being the first Black markets representative to work on behalf of Coca-Cola. But I couldn't resist looking at those papers. And I really had to, because they really filled in the period between, you know, the war, when he was in the army doing publicity for the army, and then when he does start working for Coca-Cola. And it's actually integral to his becoming a commercial marketer, because he becomes essentially the public relations representative for the Republic of Liberia within the states. And the Republic of Liberia is about to celebrate its centennial in 1947. And he's essentially responsible for organizing that in many ways, and then also organizing the big celebration that is to be held in Monrovia, but then also publicizing that and getting money for it. And in the process of doing that, one of the ways that he really pitches this initiative and Liberia itself to U.S. politicians, but also business leaders, is that Liberia is a Western country. It's a capitalist. A democratic, and it's been so essential to the war effort, but it's also a new market, also a new market where American products can be sold. And to do that, though, he needs to present West Africans, Black West Africans, as being consumers, right? As being open to consuming, and therefore he needs to present them against the stereotype of Africans. So present them as modern, present them as desiring to have stuff, and present them as being open to appeals from American businesses. And at the same time, he also is writing to American businesses, pitching his services on approaching both West African, but also African American markets during the post-World War II period. Taking advantage of the fact that that's a context of conversion, and therefore also could be a moment of transition, in which where a company used to, you know, view itself a particular way and view its markets target markets a particular way, this could be a moment for shifting that. And he's very aware of that and tries to take advantage of it.
And happening in the context of a emerging pan-Africanism and all of these kinds of ideas, where there really was a sense that African Americans were going to be connected in this. There's a long history of connection, yeah. but in terms of capitalism, it's a unique approach, and he really is, you know, down to designing their government infrastructure buildings. You know, I mean, it's really the endeavor to connect with Liberia and to celebrate the centennial is a really involved, you know, it's not just, oh, here's this one marketing campaign. I mean, it's what you discovered is so extensive.
Yeah, no, I mean, to your point, you know, how to design Monrovia, how to design the expo that is planned there. And then all of the different, you know, Kendricks organizes this Liberian news service, right? And so all the different press items that he puts out through that to all of these different, you know, media organs, in a sense, during that time period. And then also soliciting the support of politicians, but politicians, states, and then business is all, you know, it speaks a lot to Liberia's dependence on the United States, right? But also how much both Black Americans, but also the United States and U.S. officials really were trying to figure out how this West African Republic would be useful in a post-war period.
Right. Wonderful. I want to turn to John Johnson. His depiction, as you analyze it, of Black female sexuality is fascinating. You offer a nuanced class and race-based analysis. I hoped you could tell us a little bit about that, and especially your discovery about pinups.
Yes. Sure. No, you know, it's interesting because so many people have written, actually not enough people. People generally write about Ebony in terms of what I described before, it being kind of this middle class or a manual for middle class Black life and a celebration of, you know, the best and the firsts of African-American society and celebrity. And but in doing that, a lot of historians speak to its historical significance for being able to speak to all of these different Black interests or topics. And that is true. But one of the things that I was trying to figure out was how Ebony succeeded when no one had before, you know, how this commercial enterprise of a Black magazine succeeded, because there hadn't been one that lasted more than several years up to that point. And what I argue is that Johnson used a tried and true marketing technique of using, you know, sexy images of women on his magazine covers. And while that did not jibe necessarily with what the content was inside, it helped. There's just no doubt that it helped propel sales of the magazine because, you know, for the first, and this is important for Johnson because Johnson says he won't take any advertising until his magazine hits a certain circulation, because he's trying to establish his magazine as something different from kind of, you know, lower quality magazines that had come before. And so he really needs to hit that circulation number, because magazines survive on their advertising, not their newsstand sales. So, and I think it's part of the reason that when the success of using these images of African-American women, these sexualized images of African-American women and pinup images on the magazine, definitely on the magazine, but also in the magazine in different ways, I think you can see his loyalty to that strategy across all of his magazines in the 1950s, 60s. I mean, whatever the content of the magazine is, they generally have sexualized images of, you know, attractive, typically light-skinned Black women on the front, unless they move to a picture of celebrity. And so I think that, you know, in the book, I argue that his reliance on such imagery, you know, resulted in him having the most powerful Black media empire in the world and in history to that point.
It was an enormous achievement against a lot of odds, and for sure. Yeah. Well, I am so appreciative to you for talking about your book. I wanted to ask if I could bring us towards some contemporary topics and, of course, continue to hear your insights into the past as they form a context for understanding the present. In particular, I wondered if you could speak to the significance of contemporary imagery that's being used to define citizenship in the age of the internet and cell phones and the cheap production of t-shirts, murals, and so on. And I'm particularly thinking of the ways in which images of victims of police violence, like Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, and the ways that the independent person is creating stories, creating images through vehicles like TikTok and Twitter and Instagram. Has this new contemporary way of creating images changed the way that citizenship can be defined as accessible to all? Have Kendrick's efforts been co-opted by a broader audience, that you don't longer need a public relations specialist, but you can have individuals telling us what citizenship looks like?
Yeah, no, it's just a good set of questions, Ben. And I've really been wrestling with this. You know, I think that the fact that most people have a smartphone And that allows them to create images. And then all these social media platforms allows people to circulate them and manipulate them and circulate them and circulate them to particular groups or within particular groups, I think gives, you know, the average person control that once was largely, you know, through institutions or corporations, or even, you know, like Amos Kendricks having, you know, being the one who's facilitating or you know, overseeing what, say, Coca-Cola presents in terms of a Black image. So I think there's definitely some power in being able to make and deploy those images, you know, on an individual basis. I've been really thinking a lot about what it means in terms of citizenship, like the relationship between that ability and kind of ideas of citizenship, and then particularly representations of Black citizenship. Right. And I think each of us, you know, if we have Facebook or something, we have our Facebook feed, and our quote unquote friends are circulating images that we respond to, and we, in doing that, we craft a particular idea, you know, a particular identity for whatever group, for ourselves or for Black Americans. The one thing that has been really troubling to me is that I think the image of Black citizens, I did a talk recently and somebody asked me, I did a talk, Black History Month for me is just, is a lot of talks on kind of, you know, like just well-known Black figures and particularly civil rights figures. And so talking about Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, and a question came who I thought Black icons were now, or the icons of this moment. And I really stumbled on it. And I realized it was because I think that the, when we're talking in terms of visuals, I think that the icons of our moment are these victims of police brutality. And, you know, and so, and those are the images that are circulating wide, you know, like mainstream and across, you know, all of our social media platforms and all of our individual contents, whether we, you know, whatever our politics are, or, you know, race politics or otherwise. And so those are the images that in a way are, they are defining Black citizenship as indictments of Black citizenship often. But they're so different from the images that, say, Moss Kendricks and John Johnson were putting out in the post-World War II period, which were very much, you know, in keeping with this, again, this iconic American dream, middle-class consumerist kind of ideal. And I really am concerned about the effect of that for several reasons. One, I just think it's very hard for, I can speak to this personally, it's hard for people of color to see these images circulating. So much. And I think that images do work. So when you have, you know, just seemingly a countless amount, a countless stream of images of denigrated Black bodies, I think that while that's evidence and can be used to marshal, you know, on behalf of trying to get justice, it is also, you know, it's images of denigrated Black bodies. And then I also think that these images are sometimes being used as like visual avatars for people's activism or activist self, so that you can trade in these images to be, you know, to show your politics, to show what enrages you, to, you know, but that it doesn't, it's not the activism that's necessary to make such images, you know, a rarity.
Right, right. I was pondering the question of who they are, and your work really challenges the small c conservatism of these images that Coca-Cola is putting out, and that that Kendricks is putting out, and that John Johnson is capitalizing on, are these pretty staple kind of, sometimes they're just wearing the same clothes and standing in the same poses as is in the white ads. And sometimes they're the same pinup, but now mm-hmm. Black women instead of white women. And it seems to me that the ability to have an independent or an also experience is a hard one in the time period that you're looking at. And I think moving forward, even the kinds of Blackness that are marketable. During the Obama administration, there were a number of ads that had kind of lookalikes that it's like, oh, it's Obama advertising orange juice. No, it's just a lookalike trying to trick you into thinking that you can get a better rate on your mortgage or something. It seems to me that there are limitations even in what we can imagine around Blackness and around Black people as people. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that's part of your point about some of the most prominent images are of death. I mean, I would just say Beyonce and Amanda Gordon are kind of two hopeful counters, I think. I do think we've seen a number of African-American leaders in entertainment and sports and so on, really speaking out about whether they should hold professional sports in Georgia. Should Coca-Cola be banned or boycotted for their support of the GOP and QAnon and the white supremacy that led them to sign this, led the governor Kemp to sign this most recent voter suppression bill.
Right.
I think it may not be a singular force, but I think that's part of the democratization is having many people speaking out, which is what was happening in the 50s and 60s too. But we, as the image makers, kind of narrowed it down to the handful.
And I think, you point to something really important there because, particularly in talking about, these sports figures and celebrities talking about boycotting Georgia, it in a capitalist society, right, representation, I mean, it's what I'm tracking in the post-war period, but, that is a really effective means for changing representation or demanding different representation, both in terms of like different images or ideas of, but also representation, like you represent me, is by, through your consumer self. And that's what these celebrities and athletes are saying, like, fine, we'll take our business elsewhere and we'll encourage those people who support us to do that. And now particularly Black athletes have the ability to do that in a way that they did not have, Black athletes or celebrities, they did not have in a post-war period. And actually fairly, up to a recent point, and arguably even now, given the number of times that when a Black athlete does say something, you'll have someone say, like, Laura Ingram, shut up and dribble, but to take it to the market is again, a very effective, not necessarily, I say that in a neutral sense, effective way to shift something. One of the things that I, I'm sure to say to people who, when I think they didn't get it from reading the book sometimes, is that I'm not saying that what Kendricks and Johnson and the images that they put forth aren't problematic and that we aren't dealing with some of the consequences of that now, because I think it is the reason that we have such an idea of, the ideas of Blackness that have been popularized in a civil rights, a post-civil rights era are so middle class and safe, that anything that steps out of those bounds is suspect and not worthy of protection, right? Which is why so often I think that marginalized communities, and particularly Black Americans, if there is, like a Trayvon Martin or a Michael Brown case, you'll have one camp who's just saying, he's a thug, look at all these examples of him, gold teeth, hoodie, flipping a finger, whatever. And then, the supporters or family, loved ones of that individual be going back with, pictures of, like, I think about Trayvon Martin with his sister or with his cap and gown and things like that. And that back and forth of good versus bad images is such a trap. It's such a trap, I think. And so I think that is directly related to some of the Black image making activities that, I think are actually historical, throughout U.S. history, but that I'm speaking about specifically in the post-war period.
This has been so interesting, Dr. Greer. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon and participating in this interview for This Week in Black History, Society, and Culture, a podcast program of the Black and African Diaspora Forum of Monmouth University.
Thank you so much.